Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast.
Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. Hope you guys are doing well wherever you are. And today's episode, as you can probably glean from the title, is about the smartest man to ever live, William Sidis. We're not just telling his story, though. We're also going to talk about Albert Einstein, compare the two men, because while both were extremely intelligent people in history, one was treated a lot better than the other. And so we're going to talk about the why behind that and the fact that, you know, Albert Einstein is a household name, whereas William Sidis is not. Like, you know, certain people in certain communities have heard of him, but really not everybody. And so we're going to talk about that as well, and also the evolution of the IQ test, where the IQ test came from, what does it stand for, you know, all of the things involved in that, and I will also share my personal opinions surrounding the IQ test and just using numbers to define someone's intelligence. You know, I have thoughts and feelings about that. So all of that and more in today's episode. Hope you guys enjoy this one, and yeah, I mean, I guess we're just going to get on into it. I have a lot of Smarties to talk about. A lot of Smarties. I also love Smarties, the candy. I need to get my hands on one of those little, it just brings me back. I wonder if the grocery store sells Smarties. I might have to go get some after this. But yeah, thank you guys for being here. And strap in. We are going back in time and talking about some smart cookies. So the history of IQ begins in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, during a time when the scientific community was extremely interested in understanding human intelligence. And one of the earliest figures in this field was a man named Sir Francis Galton, a British polymath and a cousin of Charles Darwin, who you might recognize that name, Charles Darwin. But Galton, Sir Francis Galton, was fascinated by the idea of measuring human abilities and believed that intelligence was largely hereditary. So, you know, if your, you know, great-great-great-grandfather and then your grandfather after that and your father, you know, are deemed, quote, smart, intelligent, capable, then, you know, surely it should be hereditary. In 1884, he opened the Anthropometric Laboratory in London, where he measured various physical and cognitive traits of visitors, such as reaction time to different things, sensory acuity, and memory. And while his methods were rudimentary, I mean, this was the 1880s when this was happening, while they were rudimentary, his work laid the groundwork for future studies in psychometrics, which is the field dedicated to measuring mental, you know, abilities, mental faculties. I'd never heard of that, psychometrics. So this kind of, you know, was the very humble beginnings of this field. The next major milestone in all of this, in the, you know, laying the groundwork for IQ and things of that nature to come into play, came from French psychologist Alfred Binet. In the early 1900s, Alfred Binet was commissioned by the French government to develop a tool that could identify students who needed special education assistance. Working with his colleague, Theodore Simon, Binet developed the first practical intelligence test in 1905, known as the Binet-Simon scale. And this test measured a variety of cognitive abilities like reasoning, problem solving, and memory. Importantly, Binet introduced the concept of mental age, which is the age at which an individual's intellectual performance corresponds to the average performance of children in a specific age group. That's a lot of words, but essentially it's like, you know, it's kind of like reading level, if you think about it. Like, you know, you could be in fifth grade, but reading at a seventh grade reading level or a second grade reading level, you know, depending on your abilities. So it's kind of, you know, it's more so how old it seems that you would be based on your mental abilities, pretty much, but which doesn't always correspond with your actual age if you're following. So Binet and Simone worked on that. Binet's work was groundbreaking, but he was also cautious about how this test should be used. He believed that intelligence was far too complex to be captured by a single number and warned against using his test to label individuals permanently. Unfortunately, you know, people didn't really take his caution seriously, and, you know, they did. They did use his test to ultimately come up with a number that would define people, and I'm sure this wasn't what he wanted, given the fact that he literally gave this warning, like, don't use just one specific number to label people's intelligence, but people didn't seem to listen. So the concept of IQ, let's talk about that now that we've kind of gotten through the more rudimentary tests that were made. The concept of IQ as we know it today was introduced by the German psychologist William Stern in 1912. Stern proposed the idea of the intelligence quotient, IQ, calculated by dividing an individual's mental age, which we just talked about, mental age, by their chronological age. So their like mental age, which would be determined by, you know, how they perform on these tests and such, divided by their actual age, like, you know, since being born age, and multiplying that result by 100 to obtain a score. And this formula allowed for essentially comparison to be done, you know, comparison of individuals, like who is the higher IQ, theoretically, who would be more capable of doing this, you know, really high level, very, you know, hard, intellectually stimulating job, you know, having a higher IQ could theoretically, again, I don't believe in all this, theoretically make you better suited. So that all happened in 1912. The concept of IQ was created by William Stern. Remember back in 1905, the Binet-Simon scale, that was the first practical intelligence test created that measured, you know, all of the different, the cognitive, the reasoning, the problem solving, and memory. You know, and he also, they came up with the concept of mental age. So the Binet-Simon test was later adapted for use in the United States by psychologist Lewis Terman, who is a Stanford University psychologist, and he expanded and standardized the test for American children. Terman's version, known as the Stanford Binet Intelligence Scale, was published in 1916 and quickly became the most widely used intelligence test in the world. Terman's work popularized the idea of the IQ score. So the IQ score was involved, like that term was involved in this intelligence scale. It was kind of all like one concept, if you think about it, like just determining someone's mental age, dividing it by their actual age times 100. Like that, this test that was developed, you know, by Lewis Terman, kind of like fine-tuning the other stuff that had come before, put IQ on the map and popularized the idea of the IQ score as a measure of innate intelligence and helped to establish IQ testing as a common practice in schools and in the military. So, speaking of military, during World War I, the U.S. Army adopted IQ testing to screen and classify recruits, administering the Army Alpha and Beta tests to over 1.7 million soldiers. And these tests were designed to measure verbal and nonverbal intelligence and help solidify the role of IQ testing in large-scale assessments. But the widespread use of these tests also led to concerns about their potential for misuse, especially when it came to drawing conclusions about the intelligence of different racial and ethnic groups. While IQ tests became a standard tool for measuring intelligence at this time, they also sparked significant controversy. And, you know, like I mentioned, one of the main criticisms has been the issue of cultural bias. Early IQ tests were often criticized for being biased towards the cultural, linguistic, and educational backgrounds of white Western populations. And as a result of that, people from different cultural or social economic environments and backgrounds often scored lower which led to inaccurate and unfair conclusions about their intellectual abilities. And, you know, this being said, it's like socioeconomic is important, but also, you know, people that English isn't their first language and they're being administered this test in English, you know, there's just a lot of unfairness going on in the initial stages of this being rolled out. Another criticism revolves around the interpretation of IQ scores. Some psychologists and educators argue that placing too much of an emphasis on a single number can oversimplify the complexity of human intelligence. Like I said earlier, like at the very top of the episode, you know, intelligence, being smart, is multifaceted. It is much deeper than just saying like, oh, you scored this, that means you must be smart. You know, it's encompassing not just logical and verbal abilities, you know, your ability to test take, but also creativity, emotional intelligence, practical skills, and more. So by focusing narrowly on the abilities measured by IQ tests, we risk overlooking other important parts of cognitive function. So of course there's criticisms, but you know, IQ, everyone's heard of IQ, I want to say. Like most people have heard of IQ. Maybe they don't know what it stands for, but an IQ test, like that has become kind of like also a part of pop culture. There is an important story here to share about an individual with the highest IQ. So whether you believe in IQ to measure intelligence or not, there is someone who had the highest IQ. Yeah, like an unbelievably high IQ. And I want to share his story today. When you think about like, who could this person be? Who is the smartest person in history? The one with the highest IQ? You might think, oh, like Albert Einstein, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, Elon Musk. Probably not a man named William James Sidis. Yeah, not a household name. I had to look up how to pronounce his last name because I actually had never heard of him prior to doing research on this man. But he is coined, or kind of, you know, by people who do know IQ and the just his story, his very sad tale, to be honest, calls him the smartest man who ever lived. And so today we are going to talk about William James Sidis. He was an extraordinary individual whose brilliance often went unnoticed. And like I said, he lived a rather sad life because of the way he was treated, because of his extreme intelligence. So we're going to explore the life of one of the most enigmatic and misunderstood prodigies of the 20th century. I'm always interested in talking about prodigies who I feel like maybe were hyped up for the wrong reasons back in their prime and have been since forgotten. Like that is something that I really am interested in. So we're going to tell William's story today. But we have to, of course, start at the very beginning. William James Sidis was born on April 1st, 1898 in New York City to parents who were themselves no stranger to intellectual achievement. His father, Boris, was a renowned psychologist, and his mother, Sarah, was a physician. So two very smart parents, you know, in their respective fields. And from the beginning, it was clear that William was no ordinary child. By the time he was just 18 months old, William was able to read the New York Times. At age two, he taught himself Latin, and by age six, he was fluent in eight languages, including Greek, French, Russian, German, and Hebrew. William's father, Boris, was extremely interested in early childhood education. So, you know, while other kids his age, William's age, were focusing on sports and, you know, just simple fun tasks, being entertained, you know, maybe exploring different interests, he was kind of thrust into a different sort of lifestyle because of his parents. I mean, let's not forget, by the age of 18 months, when William was 18 months old, he was reading the New York Times. Like, you know, usually I feel like parents wouldn't be egging you on to read the New York Times at just 18 months. Like, I don't even know how that's possible. So at just 9 years old, William was accepted into Harvard University because of his parents' efforts into, you know, making him into this prodigy, although he was also just gifted. I mean, theoretically, parents could try all they want to get their child to be intelligent, but unless they, like, actually have the capability of doing that, you know, you might have fruitless efforts. So anyway, I digress. So at age nine, William was accepted into Harvard University, a feat that was unheard of at this time. He didn't actually attend until he was 11, so just 2 years later. But imagine being an 11-year-old child. Like, I don't even remember what it was like being 11 years old, walking the hallowed halls of one of the most prestigious universities in the world, surrounded by students 10 years older than you, like maybe, okay, maybe a little less than 10, but like, and professors, like all of these people who are vastly older than you and seemingly so much wiser than you. William James Sidis's time at Harvard was nothing short of remarkable. His intellect was dazzling, and he quickly became a sensation, attracting attention from both the academic world and the media, of course, because, you know, this was unheard of. He was giving lectures on four-dimensional bodies, astounding professors with his understanding of complex mathematical concepts. He was 11 years old, guys. But despite this intellectual prowess that William possessed, he struggled with the intense pressure and scrutiny that came with being a prodigy. The public's fascination with his genius became overwhelming for William, and the expectations that he carried were immense, were probably so difficult to carry, to manage. By the time he graduated at age 16, the spotlight had taken its toll on William. He developed a deep resentment of the fame and attention that his genius had brought him, and he later expressed that he had very little interest in the accolades and the recognition that others sought, you know, or sought for him. Like, his parents were so interested in him becoming this prodigy, and he had no interest in it all. After Harvard, William attempted to lead a quiet life away from the limelight. He did continue, you know, in academia. He briefly taught mathematics at Rice University in 1915 as a graduate fellow working towards his doctorate. And he taught three classes. He taught two different kinds of geometry and freshman math. And he actually wrote a textbook in Greek also. So really, really fascinating. But after less than a year, he was frustrated with the department and his teaching requirements and his treatment by students that were older than him. If you think about it, like, imagine being taught by someone younger than you, like how you would treat that person, how you would kind of push them around. And it doesn't seem like William also really had the social skills, because he had no way to have learned the social skills. He wasn't, you know, playing sports or doing things that his kids his own age were doing. So he really struggled. And because of this, he left. He left the position and returned to New England after less than a year. When a friend later asked William why he left, he said, quote, "I never knew why they gave me that job in the first place. I'm not much of a teacher. I didn't leave. I was asked to go." So, yeah, the truth comes out. He was asked to leave because he just wasn't doing what they wanted him to do. Again, the expectations were probably so heavy on his shoulders. You know, this child prodigy, he's going to grow up. And then how do you act? You know, how do you, again, without the social skills, that in just the ability to be a child, to, you know, experiment and do all the things that kids do, right? So anyway, William then after that abandoned his pursuit of a graduate degree in math and enrolled at Harvard Law School in September of 1916. But he withdrew in good standing in his final year in March 1919. So I don't really know what that exactly means, withdrew in good standing in his final year, but it does signal to me, like, with good standing, that part I'm kind of stuck on. But what I do know is that he was withdrawn, like he did not finish, he did not graduate. And shortly after all of that, in 1919, William was arrested due to his involvement in a political protest. He was a staunch pacifist and socialist and participated in a May Day parade in Boston that turned violent. And the demonstration was organized by groups protesting the U.S.'s involvement in World War I and advocating for workers' rights. And if you're a big history buff, you definitely have heard of this time period in history. Sounds like a really, honestly, exciting time to be alive in terms of, you know, people standing up for what they believe in. And William was one of those people. And during the parade, clashes between protesters and the police erupted, leading to arrests. And William was among those arrested and was charged with rioting, assault, and other offenses. And at his trial, William passionately defended his beliefs, stating he was against war and militarism, but he was convicted and sentenced to 18 months in prison. However, after serving a few months, William's sentence was suspended on the condition that he remain under his parents' supervision. Supervision, in their minds, meant holding him essentially hostage, like holding their son in a sanitarium where they were pretty much trying to get him, like reset him back to his factory settings, like before he became this rebellious, you know, young person, which is, again, so normal for him to be doing at this point in his life, you know, being a teenager, being, I think at this point he was like early 20s, So anyway, yeah, he was held hostage essentially by his parents and like against his will kind of forced to get back into his old ways, his old routine. Like, you know, they were wanting him to be just this perfect child prodigy or, you know, young prodigy, this really smart person that they get to say that they raised. So they were doing that in New Hampshire, and then they took him to California, where he spent another year under constant supervision. And all during this time, he was pretty much threatened by his parents. Like, they said that if he didn't obey and agree with what they wanted, he would be sent to an insane asylum, in their words. So William returned to the East Coast in 1921, but quickly took the opportunity to move to New York City, where he naturally grew apart from his parents, which was probably so good for him, probably the best for what they made him go through, you know, trying to revert him back to what he was before he had any like thoughts or feelings of his own. So this experience had a profound impact on William, further fueling his desire to lead a private life away from the public eye and people that could, you know, poke fun at him or just give him any more attention that he didn't want. By the age of 24, William had retreated from public life almost entirely. So remember, you know, he was going to Harvard by the age of 11 and then became a professor at like the age of 15 or 16. And then, you know, went through his rebellious phase. His parents tried to get him back to quote normal. And then now 24, he's lived such a long, jam-packed, crazy life. In, you know, a few, like in just a, such a short period of time, like these are all years that you should be, you know, experimenting and being imaginative and maybe slightly rebellious. And, you know, he did not really get a chance to do that, to be social, to, you know, join clubs and sports teams, fraternities, you know, stuff like that, like the things that a teenager should be doing and someone in their early 20s. So fast forward to now at the age of 24, William was kind of over it. He was like, you know what? I'm not going to give people anything to talk about anymore. Because, you know, while I'm interested in intellectual things, in learning, in math and things of that nature, I don't want to give fuel to other people to make stories about me. I don't want my parents involved anymore. I'm so sick of it all. So he retreated from it all, from public life, and took on various low profile, low paying jobs, you know, working as a clerk, doing menial tasks, all while continuing to pursue his intellectual interests in secret. So he still, again, was interested in this stuff, but he just didn't want it to become a spectacle and a news story. So William wrote extensively under at least 8 pseudonyms.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So he wrote books on subjects ranging from cosmology to Native American history. And his book on Native American history is actually one of his most notable works. It was called The Tribes and States, published in 1935, and it gave a history of the settlement of the Americas from the prehistoric times to 1828, which is a lot of stuff there, obviously, that he had to sift through. And he dedicated his time to, literally in secret, with no, like, his name was not attached to it. And we probably will never know how many books he published under fake names. Like, there's no way for us to know because he had so many different pseudonyms. So he was writing a lot of books during this time. He was also writing a lot about one specific topic, which is streetcar transfer tickets. At this time, it would have been kind of an equivalent or the equivalent to a bus ticket. He was really obsessed with transportation and streetcar transportation and things of that nature, like really every angle of it. Like he loved to write about it, very obsessed with that one specific topic, which is known, like his biographer suggests, that he would consider himself actually a paradromophile, which is a term used for people fascinated with transportation research and streetcar systems. So, and small aside, if you ever watched the show Big Bang Theory, Sheldon, who's, I mean, they're all really smart, all the main characters of this show, obviously all fictional, but Sheldon, one of the main characters, my favorite character, to be honest, in Big Bang Theory, has an obsession with trains. And so that kind of made me think of him. So yeah, William at this time was still using his intelligence, was still clearly a very smart person, but just didn't want to be in the limelight. And so he kind of stayed a bit more under wraps with what he was working on. Recently, actually, an inscribed copy of a book that William wrote in 1925 called The Animate and the Inanimate was sold in London to an anonymous collector for £5,000, which is almost $8,000. So yeah, people are interested in the life that he led. William's secret writing pursuits also led to the invention of a language. Yes, William invented a language, because of course he did, called Vendergood. And his biographer briefly described the language in the manuscript, but the whole work is not publicly available. And the language was mostly based on Latin and Greek, but it also drew on German and French and other Romance languages. So yes, he invented a language. He did so many things, but he just didn't want recognition for it because, you know, when he had gotten recognition for it, he wasn't really treated very well. You know, he was kind of treated as this, you know, bearded lady, you know, at the fair. Yet, despite his efforts to live this simple secret life under the radar, nose in a book or hands occupied with writing, the press continued to hound him, fascinated by the idea of a man who'd once been hailed as the smartest person in the world. You know, this guy that theoretically could get any job that he wanted, would be so unbelievably wealthy because of his smarts and used by all the greatest entities in the world. He was now living in relative obscurity. He was reclusive, and so they really wanted to write stories about him because they thought that this was just absolutely unimaginable, you know? And one of the most telling times of William's later life was his involvement in a legal battle against the New Yorker magazine, which had published an article mocking his attempts to lead this quiet life. Under the title, quote, "Where Are They Now?", James Thurber pseudonymously described William's life as lonely in a hall bedroom in Boston's shabby South End. In this case, in the legal battle, actually one of the most famous privacy cases in U.S. history, William unsuccessfully sued the New Yorker magazine for invasion of privacy when it published information about his private life. William was one of the first cases to address the conflict between the right to privacy and the freedom of the press, and it came out on the side of free expression. Lower courts dismissed William, saying that he was a public figure. He had no right to challenge personal publicity. So essentially they said, like, you have no right. You know, you have no right to challenge things on this because you are already in the public, and, like, you know, that would be unfair to journalists who have the right to talk about you because you're already a public figure. And so that happened. Then he lost an appeal of an invasion of privacy lawsuit at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in 1940 over the very same article. So he kept trying to come back and get justice for himself. And the judge, the presiding judge, Charles Edward Clark, expressed sympathy for William, who claimed that the publication had exposed him to public scorn, ridicule, and contempt, and caused him mental anguish and humiliation, but found that the court was, you know, the ruling was justified, that, you know, they can't, like, if you think about it, it'd be a lot of work for people to protect everyone's privacy in the world, like, and certain people are kind of, you know, that have already been talked about at great lengths for being public figures. Like, it's kind of harder to police that. So ultimately, he was not given justice. And in essence, the loss of William's privacy was an inevitable sacrifice to be made for the New Yorker's right to publish freely and the public's right to know. Like, it was kind of, you know, one of those things where, like, if they said, okay, William, like, we'll give you this, they would have to, you know, hold that up for every other person that would be written about. I mean, it's just, unfortunately, how tabloids and how journalism can be sometimes, you know, that certain people are, you know, torn apart without their consent. And to a certain extent, it's like something that, you know, just is how it is, even though I don't think it's right all the time. Like, that just kind of is how it is. So this incident, this lawsuit, kind of highlights the paradox that is William's life, a man who is both a public figure and a private individual, constantly at odds with the world's perception of him. Shortly after this whole legal fiasco, and ultimately he did not get justice, which I think is really upsetting, but ultimately, you know, he tried. He did try, which is the most important part here, and the fact that, you know, it really does, like, reading this whole story, getting to know William, like, who he really was and what he struggled with, has really allowed me to see that he was one of those really intelligent people who didn't need people to know that he was intelligent. He genuinely had interest in writing, in creating, you know, textbooks and things that could help people, that could educate people, and doing that, you know, exploration himself and getting gratification, getting, you know, feeling good about that, like, good for him. I'm happy for him. I wish things would have gone down a bit differently for him and that he could have had more, you know, more privacy overall and the ability to live his life how he wanted to live it without other people telling him what to do. But ultimately, William passed away from a brain hemorrhage in 1944 at the young age of 46, largely forgotten by the public who had once marveled at his genius. Yet, William's legacy endures in many ways. His life raises important questions about the nature of intelligence, the pressures placed on prodigies, and the often destructive effects of fame. Was William a tragic figure, a man whose potential was squandered by a society that couldn't understand or support him, or was he a man who simply wanted to live life on his own terms, free from the burdens of expectation, you know, writing under pseudonyms, doing what he could to maintain his identity as one that is kind of secret? Whichever one you go with to describe William Sidis, he was, you know, this is undeniable that he was a very intelligent person. He was, quote, the smartest man to ever live. And there weren't any tests done on him that we know of to define his IQ score into, like, a numeric, into a number. I don't think, I mean, if you, you know, pay attention to the last, like, 20, 30 minutes, he doesn't seem to be the kind of person that even wanted that for himself, like, wanted to know what kind of number would describe his intelligence. But there is, you know, studies that have been done. There's some data to suggest that considering his age and his academic brilliance, his IQ score is estimated by some to be somewhere between 50 and 100 points greater than that of Albert Einstein. And speaking of Albert Einstein, let's talk about him, because there are some similarities and some differences between William and Albert Einstein's story, both extremely intelligent people. William Sidis, like I just said, considerably smarter than Einstein in terms of the numerics, in terms of the IQ score. But what I really want to focus on is the public perception of Albert Einstein versus William Sidis. Because as we just talked about, William Sidis really didn't like the media, didn't like public scrutiny. And that was because they honestly, like, didn't really paint him in this great light. They kind of treated him like a science experiment, and not positively. He felt like he needed to live this private secret life because he didn't like how people were talking about him and calling him, you know, a recluse and things like that in The New Yorker. So that was how he was treated, whereas Albert Einstein was received by society in a completely different way, a positive way. Einstein, to this day, you know, like I said, I don't really know how many people know the name William Sidis versus Albert Einstein. Has kind of become synonymous with genius. Like, if you're calling someone an Einstein, that means that they are a genius or really smart. But his IQ was nowhere near that of William Sidis. So what made him so special? Why was his brand so much, quote, better than William Sidis? We're going to talk about that. So Albert Einstein, let's talk about his story. He was born on March 14th, 1879, in the city of Ulm, in the kingdom of Württemberg, in what is now Germany. Contrary to popular belief, Einstein's childhood was not marked by immediate signs of genius, of brilliance, like William Sidis's. In fact, he didn't start speaking until the age of 3, leading some to believe that he had a learning disability. However, by the time that he was in school, it was clear that young Albert possessed an extraordinary mind, especially when it came to mathematics and physics. Einstein's early education took place in Munich, where his family had relocated, and he attended the Luitpold Gymnasium, but the rigid learning environment there didn't suit him, and he often felt stifled by the traditional approach to education, and eventually left school at the age of 15. However, his passion for learning, like William's, never waned. He continued his studies independently, similarly to William, and later attended the Swiss Federal Polytechnic in Zurich, where he trained to become a teacher in physics and mathematics, similar to William. Like, you're kind of, as I go through this, I'm kind of ticking off the similarities between William and Albert Einstein. While at Zurich, Einstein's rebellious spirit and unconventional approach to problem solving began to flourish. He often rebelliously skipped class, preferring to study on his own. Despite this, he excelled in his coursework, particularly in mathematics and physics, laying the groundwork for his future discoveries, as we know him for. In 1905, at the age of 26, Einstein experimented with what is often referred to as his annus mirabilis, or miracle year. During this period, his miracle year, while working as a patent clerk in Bern, Switzerland, Einstein published four groundbreaking papers that would change the course of physics forever. These papers covered the photoelectric effect, Brownian motion, special relativity, and the equivalence of mass and energy encapsulated in the famous equation E equals mc squared, which you might remember from school. I certainly do. I have chills just reading that. But each of these contributions, as we know, was revolutionary. The photoelectric effect, for instance, provided key evidence for the quantum theory of light, which would eventually earn Einstein the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1921. But perhaps the most famous of his contributions that year was the theory of special relativity, which refined our understanding of space and time. And according to Einstein, space and time are not absolute, but relative and interwoven, dependent on the observer's frame of reference. And don't forget, guys, he's coming up with these things at the age of 26. 26, during his, quote, miracle year. 26 was not a miracle year for me. Let's just say that. Maybe it was in, like, different ways, but not in this way. So each of these was, like I said, revolutionary, and his work during 1905 established him as a leading physicist, but it was just the beginning of a career that would span decades and fundamentally alter our view of the universe. And he didn't stop there. He didn't stop with special relativity. In 1915, after years of intense work and mathematical challenges, Einstein published the theory of general relativity, which is a monumental achievement that extended his previous work to include gravity. General relativity proposed that massive objects cause a curvature in space-time, which is what we perceive as gravity. So he was just kind of debunking, like, what is gravity? Why do we see it this way? You know, the why. And this theory not only explained the peculiar orbit of Mercury, like kind of explained why there is that in Mercury's orbit, but also predicted phenomena like the bending of light by gravity, later confirmed during a solar eclipse in 1919. So these discoveries catapulted Einstein to global fame. He became a household name, and his image with his wild hair and thoughtful gaze became iconic. But Einstein wasn't just a theoretical physicist. He was also a deeply principled individual using his newfound fame to advocate for causes close to his heart. He was a vocal advocate for peace and social justice. He was a committed pacifist, especially after witnessing the horrors of World War I. So this is kind of, again, ringing bells similar to William Sidis. However, with the rise of Nazi Germany and the threat posed by Hitler, Einstein's stance on pacifism evolved. He recognized the necessity of armed resistance against such evil like Hitler, which ultimately led him to sign a letter to President Franklin D. Roosevelt urging the U.S. to develop atomic weapons before the Nazis could. This letter was one of the key catalysts for the Manhattan Project, though Einstein himself was not directly involved. He used his stardom that he had gotten through his intelligence, through his inventions. He also spoke out against racism and was a strong supporter of civil rights. After moving to the U.S. in 1933, he settled in Princeton, New Jersey, where he became a member of the Institute for Advanced Study, and he spent the remainder of his life there, continuing his research, continuing his advocacy, speaking out on all sorts of issues that he was passionate about, and he ultimately passed away on April 18th, 1955, at the age of 76. His death marked the end of an era in physics, but his legacy continues to influence the world today. Again, we are still knowing and talking about Albert Einstein and his discoveries, and, you know, his impact was immeasurable. So what makes Einstein stand out above William Sidis and other geniuses? And, you know, we can kind of think about it just in the way that I told this story. He used his power for good. You know, he's remembered not just as this really smart guy, this scientist, but a symbol of intellectual curiosity, creativity, and moral integrity. He had this star power and used it to the best of his ability. His theories also laid the foundation for much of modern physics, from the understanding of black holes to the development of GPS technology. But perhaps what is most remarkable about his, you know, who he was, who Einstein was, is not just his scientific achievements, but his enduring influence as this public figure who championed the pursuit of knowledge and bettering humanity. Like, he just wanted the world to be better. That was at the core of all the things that he worked on, like on the things that he used his intelligence and his platform for, was just, he was just trying to better the world, really. And it's obvious. I think it's, you know, still so important, of course, to share William's story, even though maybe he wasn't, like, he did, you know, he went to jail for 18 months trying to, you know, he was rallying and trying to fight for peace. But I feel like maybe his story might have turned out a bit differently if he didn't have all the pressure from his parents, pressure from the media, you know, if he had just kind of been left to his own devices to live how he pleased and live by his own accord, maybe things would have turned out a bit differently for him. Maybe he wouldn't have hated the media so much if they just left him alone a little bit more, especially when he was younger in his more formative years. Maybe if his parents laid off of him and didn't send him to a sanitarium after he was just trying to speak up for what he believed in and was imprisoned for that, like, for a very short time, and, you know, ultimately could have and still did go on to do many things in his life, even given the fact that he was imprisoned for a short time. Like, you know, that was kind of just a small little blip in his life. And still, you know, he isn't known like Albert Einstein is known. And he had a higher IQ. So maybe it isn't the, you know, it's kind of an interesting conversation about maybe the numbers, again, don't really matter as much as, you know, what you're going to do with the intelligence and how you're going to, you know, or maybe that doesn't even matter more so, you know, there's people that have made huge impacts in society and don't have an IQ as high as William Sidis or Albert Einstein. You know, there are people with, you know, IQ isn't even really talked about. Like, I've never taken an IQ test personally. I know what an IQ test is, but, you know, I only took the SAT because I had to for college. Like, I had to take the SAT and the ACT to get into college. Otherwise, like, you know, I hardly think about the SAT. I don't even remember what my score was. All I know is I got into college, thank God. But, like, also, it really does not define you. Like, you know, you won't be asked by most employers what your IQ was, or what your IQ was, what your SAT score was, or your IQ, you know. So it's just an interesting kind of antiquated thing, I feel like, but still important to talk about these things, because of course, history becomes, you know, it repeats itself often. So it is a good conversation to have. And that is a wrap on our episode, Uncovering IQs and Genius Minds in History. And yeah, this has been an episode chock full of trivia answers. I love good trivia night. So you never know when someone will try to test your IQ and you'll have some things to share because of this episode. So thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you for listening to another episode of Found Objects History Podcast. I will be back next week with another episode, but I think I mentioned this last week. We are about to wrap season one. So make sure you are all caught up on all the episodes. We're going to take a brief hiatus and then come back with a season two in some form. So yeah, I mean, still, there's a few more episodes. I haven't quite decided when we're going to cap it, but I'll let you guys know. And then we're going to, of course, continue, because I just love sharing these stories with you all. It might be in a different format. Who knows? I might try to do video. We're going to see. But yeah, thank you guys for being here. Thank you for listening. And remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.